Yes.
But there's sort of this famous Bhajapani story about taking Sam Rinpoche to the dentist for a root canal. And he refused any kind of Novocaine and showed the aspect of like falling asleep in the chair and not feeling pain at all. So
yeah.
I'm just wondering, how can a being like that feel pain as pain to projection caused by their negative karma?
Right.
Questions is like, did he really feel pain? And if so, why?
Right. Once you reach Buddhahood, you don't, we remember the definition of having a bad day. Karma and klesha, karma and mental affliction. Once you reach Buddhahood, and in that place where you are, if you're Song Rinpoche, and if you're an enlightened being, you could not feel the pain of the dental drill, even if you wanted to. You could beg the guy, please keep it in there and see if you hit something, you know. And he could all day go like that, and you wouldn't feel anything except bliss. At an enlightened being stage, I was talking more arhat and below, okay? Meaning, especially at the state of arhat or nirvana, you can never again be upset or have any bad emotion towards the drill, which is the breaking your perfection of patience, or have any kind of being upset or hatred towards the dentist, or even towards your own habit of eating candy. You know, you just don't have that anymore. You're incapable of it. And that's the point. You will still feel the pain. It's called the difference between, say, Hagne, Nyangde, Hakche, Nyangde. At Hakche Nyangde, it's called, you still have something left over. You still have this dirty body and world which was created by dirty things called karma and mental affliction. When those wear out, either because you sit and wait for it to wear out, which takes a long time, or because you do your four powers very effectively, you reach Pagme Nyangde, which means nirvana with nothing left over, and there ain't no more suffering, samsaric parts of you anymore to make you suffer. So, to get from Hagje Nyangde to Hagme Nyangde is a long trip. So if he was at Hagje Nyangde, he could have either felt the pain or not felt the pain according to his past karma. If he was at Hlang Mae Nyangde, he couldn't have ever felt the pain if he wanted to. You know, so, like that. Okay, yeah.
That's your remorse as opposed to intelligence regret?
Yeah, good. Or I like to say guilt.
Oh,
I mean, yeah.
That's what I'm asking about.
Okay,
actually.
Yeah.
I think I hear you. I think putting together what you're saying, what I understand is that the negative karmic results that happen, even from me hurting someone else, are happening from that being's side, not from my side. So that even if I kill someone, in a sense, there's no reason for guilt because the karmic result is coming to them by their own negative actions, and that karma is a very selfish thing, that I really, the way I can make karma work is to be utterly selfish. It's going to hurt me, so I shouldn't do it, not that it's going to hurt them, so I shouldn't do it, because their negative results are going to come to them, whatever I do. But that seems like such an opposition to the bodhisattva motivation. And I've also heard Lama Zopa talk about regretting an action because it gave the other being an opportunity to create negativity.
Right.
So
right.
I wanted to ask you about
that. Okay. And Shanti Deva says that too. Maybe they're the same person. But anyway... definition of morality in the opening lines of Jetsun Kappa's essence. What's it called? What is it called? essence of the ocean of Vinaya. He says, "Yenjun sabe gyuchine shinishi dan chevale doba dea mungale." He says the definition of pratimoksha morality in particular, like monks or nuns morality, is that you stop hurting other people for the reason that you are tired of suffering in samsara. Okay, very interesting. You stop hurting other people for the reason that you are tired of living this kind of a life. Okay. But I would just say this, and I don't want to go too long on about it, but you should get into a state of mind where you say, okay, when I hit somebody in the face, if they feel pain, that's their problem. You know, they collected bad karma. They are experiencing their own suffering from it. It's got nothing to do with me. I may be the instrument by which they receive their bad karma, but it's not me who's causing the pain. Ultimately, it's always their own projection onto that smacking sound, which is forced on them by their past karma, and therefore it hurts them when I punch them. And you also know there exist people who enjoy it when you punch them. I mean, there's some kind of weird sexual thing where people like it, you know, like a masochist or something. So there, a punch is not inherently unpleasant. Some people find it pleasant. Seriously. So that does that mean that you can go around punching people? You know, that's the first answer. I mean, obviously not. I mean, because punching, like in the Vinaya, you're not even allowed to pretend to hit somebody. You're not even allowed to pretend to hit somebody, like, you know, like that. Because of the similarity to the real thing. Because it gets you in the habit of punching. You know, it's like eating vegetarian turkey cutlet. You know, you know, it gets your mind, or this alcoholist wine, you know. It gets your mind in the mode of eating meat or drinking alcohol. And what I mean is that by punching the person, there are so many implications about what happens to you. There are actually four discrete results coming to you by you will go to a lower birth, you will get punched back in your next life, you will enjoy punching in the future, and you will live in a world where people punch each other. Those four things will happen when you punch somebody. So you shouldn't punch people. But it is true that if they feel any pain, that's because of their own karma. But it absolutely doesn't mean that you can go around punching people. Is it selfish to refrain from punching people only for the reason that it won't, that you're watching out for your own rear end? You know, is that a bad motivation, or is that an inferior motivation? It seems that way. It smells that way. It feels that way. But it doesn't preclude bodhicitta at all. I mean, it is initial scope lam rim. Okay? It is lesser scope lam rim. People who reach higher scope lam rim don't give up lesser scope lam rim. They build on it. Okay? So, don't punch other people, because it is going to cause you problems. On top of that, don't punch them because it hurts them. Okay? And on top of that, don't punch them because you will be opening an opportunity for them to get angry and collect more bad karma themselves. So all three are true. But build on each one. Okay? Not contradictory. That's a trick. That's a kawe ne, means a subtle trick in the scriptures or something like that. I'll answer one more question, then I'd like to take a break. Okay? Two more. It's very interesting. You know, I actually, when I taught karma in New York, we had a lot of questions come up. And I actually took one of my students to Bombay with me. and we went to the monastery. It was Tom Kiley. And we went to the monastery and we asked my scripture teacher this very question. You know, what's going on with Hitler? Because technically speaking, and I hate to talk about this subject because it's emotional for a lot of people, but I'm speaking from purely a theoretical point of view. If Hitler truly believed that he was being of service to humanity, if he really had that motivation, then there was an element of good karma in what he did. And there is a, from the point of view of motivation, he did collect some good karma if he truly believed he was helping humanity. Even if it was out of ignorance. And they give the example in the Abhidharma. I can quote a scriptural, you know, Shungi Jukje. There's a discussion of euthanasia in the fourth chapter of the Abhidharma. Is it okay to kill, and the example is your parents, if they are suffering? You know, if you truly believe that it would be merciful to kill your parents, and out of an ignorant kind of mercy, you cause their death, Do you collect one of the five great bad deeds? You know, the five are killing your mother, killing your father, killing an arhat, trying to hurt a Buddha, and splitting up the Sangha during the time of the Buddha. And the scripture says, well, I shouldn't say much. It is a very bad deed. It doesn't, from the point of view of the action, but from the point of view of the motivation of virtue. Okay? The motivation is virtuous and does have its own good results. There are four elements in any karmic act. Shi, Sampa, Jora, Tatu. Shi, Sampa, Jora, Tatu. And Sampa means motivation. So one quarter of the deed was virtuous. And three quarters was horribly non-virtuous. And will lead to incredible suffering for that being. Hitler is definitely suffering in the lowest hell. And will continue to suffer there for millions of years along with Mao Zedong and other friends. Without question, they are suffering in the deepest hell. At some point, he will have some minor pleasant experience caused by his deluded intention to try to help somebody. Okay, and it's the same with killing your mother or father because you think it might be putting them out of some suffering or something like that. Okay. So exactly the same thing. Like that. From 99% of the actions of the act was horrible, and he's definitely suffering in the lowest hell. And then, you know, if he ever gets back out, which he will eventually, he'll have some minor pleasant experience. And that's from the motivation, from the good part of the motivation. One more question, sorry. She's been very patient. Oh, yeah. I often thought about Uma, you know, because she says, what about people who act out evil roles in a movie or something, you know, or where you're supposed to act out that you have great desire? I think in general it would be rather dangerous, you know, for a person to do that, you know, to act out a scene of sexual misconduct or something like that. I think it would be just dangerous for the person. Yeah. Yeah, I think it would be dangerous for the person. They don't have motivation. You know, they are not overcome by lust, really. They're just supposed to act like that in the movie. But they do have, it does plant some kind of a subtle seed in your mind for that kind of behavior. And that's why, I mean, a Buddhist would also say that most of the movies are not wholesome or not healthy for young people, for example. That, okay, they don't really believe that 36 people are getting blown away by Schwarzenegger at that moment. But it does plant some kind of influence on the mind. And it, as such, it's still undesirable. I went to a real... The kid, who, Ragnar, where are you? He got me to go to some really sensitive, meaningful movie. Okay. Okay, one more, then we really got to take a break. Today's a long day. She said, can you purify your bad deeds while you're in the bardo by having intense regret? And the bottom line is very, very simple. And that's a question about poa also. You know, should you wait until the last minute to get to enlightenment? And the answer is this, and it comes from my heart. I mean, the process of death, during the process of death, the physical elements of the body are in total chaos. And although the brain is not the mind, the brain rests on the mind. I mean, I'm sorry, the mind rests on the brain. Okay, so although the brain is not the mind is closely connected with the brain and with the physical body. They share a deep relationship. So when the physical parts of the body are shutting down, you know, as the senses shut down during the process of death, it throws the components of the physical body into a very serious chaos. And as a result of the chaos going on with the basis on which it's resting, it's like we were talking last night, we went to Santa Cruz, we were talking about the landfill that the mall is resting on. So if the landfill is not stable, and if it's going like that, then the buildings have to fall down. And if the brain, if the physical components of the gray matter are like going out of whack, totally chaos, it does affect the mind. even though it's not the mind, it does send the mind into total chaos. And there's a domino series of hallucinations, and they're always the same. They're always very similar. You always go through a certain series of hallucinations. And then after that, you're in the bardo, and that has other problems in the bardo. So to think that the belief that that it's wise to wait to the last minute to get to enlightenment, or that somehow, you know, it's preferable to wait till the end, is crazy. You know, it's not likely to happen. It does happen. It does happen. And a highly trained yogi, you know, can pull it off. But the odds are way, way, way against you. Yeah. 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 There is. There is such a thing as a person who enters arhatship in the bardo. Even in the Abhidharma, which is very conservative, you know. The most conservative. It does have a place for that. But very rare. Let's get it done now. You know, take care of it now. No reason to wait to do a poa. You won't be able to pull it off. You won't be able to poa it off. Okay? get it done now. Enter paradise in the next year or two. Okay? All right, take a break, all right?
Turn off your radio mic.
But listen, how do you know you're having extreme number one? How do you know you're falling off the cliff number one? And as John said, the indication is that you're having a mental affliction, and a strong one. That's an indication that you fell off the cliff. Is it the same thing as falling off the cliff? No. Falling off the cliff came just before that. And that was believing that this guy is really evil from his own side. Believing that this screaming lady boss is unpleasant from her own side. And then you must have a mental affliction. Okay? You don't have any choice. Once you've misinterpreted her, once you've said that this lady is evil from her own side, then you can have a mental affliction. And that's what's so bad about. So it's really the Yutan Zimba, the grasping to the extreme, came the moment before you got angry. And it was the belief that she is not a ripening of your own karma on a blank screen. Okay? And only then can you have a mental affliction. And only then can you do a bad karma. It's a chain reaction. You can't do a bad karma if you don't have a mental affliction coming right before it. You can't have a mental affliction unless the moment before that you are grasping to that object as self-existent and you have fallen off the cliff to the, let's call it the right. Okay? You've fallen off the right side of the cliff, which is called yata. Okay? Yeah.
You might get a very strong emotion coming up that I've always thought sometimes that in itself, that experience is arising with karma.
Mm-hmm. All experiences are.
So let's say that stomach is actually receiving that directly, right?
Yeah.
And it's a process of purifying their negative karma.
Right.
And they have a strong mental affliction rising as a result of karma being purified.
Right.
That experience itself isn't necessarily indicating that they're grasping at something.
It is. You're not seeing the three spheres of the act of purification. It's cool. All right. Let's get on to metta. So now you know yutta. Do you have yutta a lot? It comes in a millisecond before any time you are slightly like something or slightly dislike something in a samsaric way. Okay, it's always there. Okay. Mm-hmm. Is it not? Is that better? Now let's go to metta. Metta is the other extreme. 99% of all people fall off this side. 1% falls off the other side. and a few, you know, get to the city of liberation, all right? What is it to fall off the other side, which is metta? Metta means the extreme of thinking things don't exist. The extreme of thinking things don't exist, which is technically metta and dimma, okay, Dr. LeMay, all right? What is it to fall off that side? Oh, you know all the flavors of it. Things are empty. Nothing matters. It's all an illusion. Therefore, I can do what I want. You know? It's okay to steal the towels out of the hotel. They're just illusions anyway. Okay? I'm a great tantric yogi. Since everything's empty, I will impute onto the sexual misconduct holy activity. You know? This is all metta. This is all dependent on the extreme of thinking that if things weren't the way you thought they were, then they must not operate at all according to the normal rules. Or maybe not even exist at all. And the implication of that is, I can do whatever I want. Nagarjuna said samsara and nirvana are the same thing. So, I'll just stay right where I am. Okay. He didn't mean that. What he meant was they're both empty. Samsara has its projected causes. Nirvana has its projected causes. They're not anything else. From that point of view, they're the same. He didn't mean it was the same thing to sit here and suffer and get old and ugly, or to reach nirvana and paradise and not have to get old and ugly. Okay? Obviously. So, how many people fall into metta? It's very rare. You have to get some lousy Buddhist teachings. Okay? You have to get some lousy New Age books about what Nagarjuna meant when he said nothing exists, or life doesn't matter, or it's all an illusion, or something. To fall off that other extreme, especially where you discount the ethical way of living, that's the other extreme. It's rather rare. You have to be, it's a result of a crooked education in the spiritual path, okay? In a crooked spiritual path, or something like that. It's meaning mistaken. It's a result of a misunderstanding of what emptiness is. And then you can fall off the other side if you like. That one's obviously a much deeper hole than the other side. It's one thing to be blissfully ignorant of what's going on. It's another thing to actively misbehave because you don't understand emptiness. Okay? That's a different thing. So, yeah, neither one exists in the sense that the fact that everything is the way it looks doesn't exist, and the fact that nothing exists or nothing matters also doesn't exist. Holding on to those two does exist, and that causes all our trouble. That's the difference between ta and tanzin. Metta, yuta, and yupe tanzin and mebe tanzin, okay? Doesn't really matter. Anyway, to believe in either one is to fall off the cliff. And has much more painful implications than falling off a real cliff with a real body and getting killed. Okay, the implications are much more far-reaching than having your physical body fall off a cliff. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're allowed, she said, what about these teachers who show like crazy wisdom or stuff like that? In the Bodhisattva vows, for example, you're allowed to use these extraordinary methods if you have been on the highest stages of the path for several million years. Okay? And as my teacher always said, that eliminates us, doesn't it? Okay. I mean, don't kid yourself, all right? It's so rare to have someone in the world talking about ethical living, trying to practice ethical living, being a normal Dalai Lama, you know, just being a good, plain old good person and teaching good, clean, holy things, sacred things. I mean, there's not enough of those around, okay? Let's be those. you know, then the crazy wisdom is good at a certain level if you've been on the path for millions of years, and it's true, it exists, and it's real, and it's useful, and it's important, and it's enlightened. But you must learn all these things before you get there for millions of years. So stick to this stuff. Stick to this stuff. All right. I just want to make sure I cover all the homework. Okay. So if anybody asks you what's Madhyamika say, you're going to say, it's not to fall off the two cliffs. It's not to fall off the two edges, the two extremes. What are the two extremes? A, thinking everything is the way you thought it was and your boss is really bad from his side and it's not coming from you. Or two, thinking, well, if it's not coming, if it is not what it seems, it either doesn't matter or it doesn't exist. Those are the two extremes. Okay, those are the two extremes. You want to go between the two. How do you stop those two? How do you stop those two tendencies? Okay. And these are the two friends. They're called Nang Tong. Say Nang Tong. Nang Tong. And that's the last thing. Next to the last thing we're going to talk about. At least I'm honest for once, right? Nang Tong. Nang means dependent origination. It's a code word for dependent origination. It means appearances. The way things appear. The appearance of things. It's called Nang. Dependent origination. What's the lowest interpretation of dependent origination? That if something comes from causes, it must be dependently originating. It must be dependent origination. If something has its own causes and conditions, it's dependent origination. What do the medium schools say is the meaning of dependent origination? The whole depends on its parts. If something is depending on its parts, well, then that's dependent origination. They say, our view is better because your view doesn't cover things that don't have causes, like empty space or emptiness itself. And then Madhyamika Prasangika High School comes along and says, you guys are close but no cigar. The ultimate meaning of dependent origination is the things are the collection of their parts and then you have to project onto that something. Okay. And where does the projection come from? What's driving it? Your past deeds. Your own karma. Oh, a lot of correct view running around here. Okay. The fact that things exist that way, that everything around you at any given moment is your own karmic seeds ripening and causing you to interpret data in a certain way is Nang. That's Nang. That's Nang, which means appearances. In other words, you understand the appearance. It's that moment of the last instant of the second path where you're looking at the teapot and saying, this is a mental image. I'm not looking at a teapot that exists from its side. Okay. That's Nang. When you understand that, that's Nang.
Yeah.
No question. Okay. What's Tong? Tong is that a teapot which could exist out there, or a pot which could exist out there on the stove, and I'll give you all the synonyms. Rangshinki Drupa, naturally. Rangkitseniki Drupa, by definition. Dundamba Drupa, ultimately. Tenjung Mayimba Drupa, not dependently arising. Tanyenima Drupa, not a result of my projections. Rangune Drupa, existing from its own side. These are all synonyms for self-existence.
Okay?
They all mean the same thing. And when you realize that there's no such thing, that's Tong.
Okay?
Tong is the fact that there never was anything else except your projections onto certain data, being called apart. There ain't nothing else. That's Tong. Okay. How does Nang and Tong relate to the two extremes? And then we're done. Because, why did we get to this subject? We were talking about the Buddha. He's talking to Subhuti. Subhuti says to the Buddha, what do we call this book? He says, Perfection Wisdom. And then he says, there's no such thing. And then he says, okay. When he says, There's no such thing. He's trying to overcome yata. He's trying to say, things don't exist the way you thought. Why does the Buddha say, the Prajnaparamita doesn't even exist? He's trying to knock the Buddha out of his pre-assumptions about the way things are. It's like the first teaching you ever got, when the teacher got up and said, things are not the way you think they are.
Okay.
Things are not the way you think they are. And thinking that they are the way they look to you is the first extreme, the extreme of thinking that everything exists the way you thought it did. So the reason the Buddha says the perfection of wisdom doesn't even exist is that he's trying to knock the Buddha out of that belief that everything was the way he thought it was. He's trying to knock him out of that belief.
Okay?
This perfection of wisdom doesn't even exist. Since the Buddha is supposed to think, oh, he means it doesn't exist the way I thought it did.
Okay.
But then the Buddha says, hey, and that's why we can call it the perfection of wisdom. What's he saying then?
Conventionally.
It does exist conventionally, and don't think, Sabuddhi, that nothing exists or that nothing matters. Or that you can do whatever the heck you like. He's protecting from Sabuddhi from what? Extreme number two. Thinking that nothing exists or that nothing matters. If it's not the way I thought it was, which is yuta, falling off this side, well, then it doesn't matter, I can do whatever I want, it doesn't exist, which is falling off the other side. And by saying those two sentences, the Buddha is trying to protect Sabuddhi from falling off both cliffs. Hey, Sabuddhi, it ain't the way you thought it was, the Prajnaparamita doesn't even exist. Hey, Sabuddhi, it's not that nothing exists, because it does exist through your projection.
Okay.
And now I'll give you something that Pabonka, this is one of Pabonka's most, it's one of the teachings he cherished the most. He said, if you're going to be a real Madhyamika yogi, you have to make four distinctions.
Okay.
You have to make a fourfold distinction. You have to be able to tell the difference between four different things. And I'll read it to you. Nothing exists from its own side, but that doesn't mean that nothing exists at all.
Okay.
Nothing exists from its own side, but that doesn't mean that nothing exists at all or that nothing matters ethically.
Okay.
How many distinctions you got so far? It's really two. Nothing exists from its own side, but that don't mean that nothing exists at all. You got two distinctions so far.
Okay.
Then he said, everything does exist only through your projections, but that doesn't mean that they exist from their own side, without your projections. Do Buddhists believe that things exist? By projection, yes. Do they believe nothing exists? No. They don't. Do they believe nothing exists without your projections?
Yes.
Yes. What was the other one? Do they believe that everything exists through your projections? Yes.
Okay.
Do they believe that everything exists from its own side?
Okay.
So you gotta get, you know, you should be able to play with those four. You should be able to dance between those four. But then you're a real Madhyamika yogi.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a little tricky. Okay. I'll say it this way. It is true that nothing exists from its own side. That's number one. It is true that nothing exists from its own side. And you could have plugged in there naturally or anything else you want to say, but let's leave it like that. It is true that nothing exists from its own side. That's number one. Number two is, but it ain't true that nothing exists.
Okay. All right.
Or that nothing matters. I'll go through it again. Number one, it is true that nothing exists from its own side. Number two, but it's not true that nothing exists or that nothing matters. Number three, it is true that everything exists through your projection. Number three, it is true that everything exists through your projection. Number four, but it's not true that everything exists from its own side. And that's four different things. And if you want to be a good Madhyamika yogi and a good diamond cutter sutra person, you better be able to tell the difference between those four. You better be able to, like the mantra. Okay. In Pabonka would say it this way, two is's and two ain'ts. Okay. They say that. They say two is's and two ain'ts. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it ultimately comes from Nagarjuna, but yeah, Jeff. Absolutely, it does seem that. It really does seem that. It seems like one and four are the same thing. But if you think about it, they are one is positive and one is negative, is that true? Can I say it? But it's not true that everything exists from its own side. I believe that's an is, yeah. Okay. But you figure it out. Nothing exists from its own side. And it's not true that everything exists from its own side. They are very similar things. I mean, they add up to the same thing. But you have to make a distinction. Maybe the point is that contrasted to the one that comes before it in the case of four and the one that comes right after it in the case of one, that they're different effects or different points, you know. I think that might be a clue for you. And it comes out a lot better in Tibetan, to tell you the truth. Okay? Okay? Last point. No, really last point. If I tell you that one of these two prevents you from thinking that everything exists the way you thought it did. And if I tell you one of these two prevents you from thinking that nothing exists or nothing matters, which would you guess? If I tell you, for example, if I tell you, nung means, if I tell you everything exists through projection, is that going to keep you from falling off the cliff that says, everything's the way I thought it was? Or is that going to keep you from falling off the cliff of, nothing matters and nothing exists? I got to check what he said here. Mm-hmm. Which one? Yeah, so she's saying, when I say everything exists through projections, It stops you from thinking that everything was the way you thought it was. Okay. Nang wa yu ta sa si. Meta. And dong, if I come up to you and say, everything is empty of self-existence. Everything is empty of self-existence. What does that prevent? If I come up to you and say, nothing exists from its own side, what does that prevent? Prevent the first one again? Okay, now I'll tell you the punchline, alright? Most Buddhist schools say, you know, the lower schools say, this first one prevents the second extreme. Okay. Saying that everything exists by projection prevents you from thinking nothing exists. Okay. Saying that everything exists by projection prevents you from falling into the mistake that nothing exists. Everyone except the highest. Three and a half schools say that.
None prevents.
Good. None prevents metta. When I say everything exists by projection, it prevents you from thinking that nothing exists or nothing matters. When I say everything's empty of self-existence, it prevents you from thinking that things exist the way you thought they were. It prevents the first extreme. Okay, you gotta cook it, okay? This is where my lama would say, okay, you guys go home and think about it. Don't wait for me to tell you the punchline. You go home and think about it, okay? That's the position of 3.5 schools. The higher half of the school reverses it. Prasangika says, and this is very, very, very famous quotation from Jetsun Kappa. When you figure out how saying that things are projections prevents you from thinking that things are the way you thought they were, and when you figure out how saying that nothing exists self-existently prevents you from thinking that nothing exists, well, then you understand Majjhimika. I'm a saint because I'm not clear on it myself. Nanwe yota selsin, tomani. Sheyan nanwe yota sawadang. Sheyan nanwe yota sawadang means when you understand that everything is just a projection, it will stop you from thinking that everything exists the way you thought it did. Tome meta selsin, tomani. Tome meta sel means when you understand that nothing exists independently or self-existently, it'll save you from thinking that nothing exists at all. In other words, when I say nothing exists without your projection, and when I say nothing exists, that's a big difference. If someone comes up to you and accuses you, which I've been accused in a debate with a great scholar of another tradition, another religion, they come to you and say, the Garjuna said nothing exists. I said, that's not what the Garjuna said. The Garjuna said nothing exists independent of your projections. Okay? That's a big difference. So in that sense, understanding that nothing exists self-existently prevents you from thinking that nothing exists. Cool. Alright? So Pabonka takes you through that whole trip. He says, here's what the lower 3.5 schools think. And what I just said is what the higher half thinks. And then he screws up things again, and he says, but my root lama, Drupkangpa, this is Pabunka's root lama, used to say, privately to us, that they work both ways. Okay? Okay? When you understand that everything is a projection, it keeps you from falling off both cliffs. When you understand that nothing exists self-existently, it keeps you from falling off both cliffs. Okay. He's very cool about it. Why do we go into all this jazz? Is it just intellectual BS? No. By discussing the fine points, you'll never forget the main point. And I'll just state it one more time and I'll shut up. Realize that spiritually you can fall into two death traps. Two quicksands, which will suck you down and kill your spiritual being. And that's how dangerous they are. One is to think that the events which are happening around you are not your own karma ripening on an otherwise blank world. Okay? Don't believe it. If you act on that, you'll be able to remove your mental afflictions. You'll never again be angry, you'll never again be jealous, you'll never again hate. And then life is cool. You know, life without the mental afflictions, if you can even imagine it, is very, very cool. Think of going through the day without being the slightest bit irritated or the slightest kind of bad thought or anything. Going through the whole day was just cool, okay? That, just try to imagine it. I mean, that's just to avoid that first one. What's the second extreme? Do not believe those bad teachings about emptiness. You know, junk them. Spit on them. Okay? I mean, they are poison. Okay? For some guy to get up and say, everything's empty, so you can do what you like. Everything's empty, so nothing matters. Everything's empty, so you can go into Tantra and do whatever dirty thing you want to do. If you think about it, okay. You know, forget it. Okay? It's not true. That's not what it means. That's not what these things mean. Avoid them like the plague. Because falling off the back of this platform, you can break an arm or break your back, or you can kill one life. you know, fall into one of those two extremes and you made a horrible mistake that can ruin your spiritual life for many, many lifetimes.
Okay.
That's the point of the two extremes. Okay. Okay, sorry, we got a short break now, right? Sorry. And we start again at 2 o'clock. What time is it now? Okay. That was it. When you understand that things are empty of self-existence, you know, you will know, when you understand that things don't exist self-existently, you will no longer make the mistake of thinking that nothing exists in any way at all.
Okay.
I just got it clear myself. But you guys have to practice it, okay? It's tricky. Okay, you guys, let's do prayer so you got to eat kind of fast and relax and like that. Okay. Relax with your homework. I don't mind, but I'll try in the second class to leave some. Somebody yell at me at 3:30 during the second class. 3:15. I'll try to get to the second class faster.
Okay.
This gets us to. I don't think I've mentioned, except very briefly, the two realities. Okay. Two realities. They call it the two truths. Okay, but it refers to the two realities. There are two kinds of reality. One is the reality that we're living in now, and it's all you've ever known if you have not seen emptiness directly. And then the other one is ultimate reality,
okay,
which is what you are seeing when you perceive emptiness directly. I'm going to give you just the names of those two. Say Kunzok Denpa. Kunzok Denpa. Second one is called Say Dundam Denpa. Dundam Denpa. The things that are going around you are called going on around you are called Kunzok Denpa. Kunzok means fake. Deceptive.
Okay.
They are lying to you. Kunzo means they are lying to you. Denpa means truth, and in this case it means reality. And there's a huge debate in the Madhyamika scriptures about how could there ever be a thing called fake truth? How could there ever be a thing like reality which is unreal? How could there be an artificial reality? Okay. How could that be? What does that mean? And the bottom line is this. And this is Nagarjuna's mantra. And this is Tsongkhapa spent his life trying to convince people of this. That even though things are your projections, even though they are a result of that process of picking up clues, pasting them together, and calling them things, even though that's true, they still work. Even though things are empty, they still work. They're still real. They still affect us. And in fact, it couldn't have been any other way. If they were not projections, if they were not a result of that process, if they were not coming from your karmic, the ripening of karma in your own mind, they couldn't be doing what they're doing. Not only are emptiness and the way that things work, not only are they friends, they need each other.
Okay.
And this was a reaction of Tsongkhapa to people who said, if things were empty, they couldn't work.
Okay.
If things were empty, things couldn't cause other things. And he said, are you crazy? Because they're empty, they cause other things.
Okay.
Because they are empty, things cause other things. If it weren't that way, they couldn't do anything.
Okay.
Now we obviously, from all the, all of those things, we got to talk about that. So Kunzok Denpa, how is Kunzok Denpa fake? How is it fake? The main point in Kunzok is that to a normal state of mind, okay, to a normal person's mind, the way things seem and the way things are not the same. They don't correspond. And that's the description of deception. That's what it means to be fake. You know, the white liquid in the Howard Johnson's Halfway to Washington looks like cream, but it's not. And that's what artificial means. That's what deceptive means. It looks like the real thing, but it's not. The way it is and the way it looks don't match. Okay, that's what deceptive reality means. For normal people, all of these objects that you are seeing are deceptive. They look like they're not coming from your own mind's projections, which are forced on you by your past karma. They seem like that, but that ain't the way it is. Therefore, they are kunzok dhamma, deceptive reality. People mistranslate it as relative truth or something like that. Okay, that's not the point. The point is not that you couldn't tell long without short or relativity or anything like that. It's deceptive. Can a Buddha see deceptive reality? You guys are bad. I'll come back later. Now, don't forget my. I'll give you the definition of kunzok dhamma, deceptive reality, fake truth again, and then you'll catch it. To the minds of a normal person, okay, its appearance and its reality don't match. Okay, so a Buddha can see it. He can see it, but to him, of course, it doesn't look that way. It doesn't look. The appearance and the way it is are not different for him. But my definition of deceptive reality was to a normal person, to a regular old person, the appearance and the reality don't match. Dundam Demba, they do match. Okay. The appearance and the reality do match. Ultimate reality, emptiness itself. Okay. The example and the only example of Dundam Demba, the only example of ultimate reality, is that thing that you see while you're perceiving emptiness directly. I wanted to talk today a little bit about how the schools up to the Prasangika, up to the highest school, about some problems that come in their schools because they don't accept the idea of projection. They don't accept that whole concept. They think that some things must still have some existence from their own side. Okay? They are still clinging to a few things that must be existing from their own side. There must be, okay, not too many, maybe, but there must be some things that exist from their own side independent of our projections. What about the data that you are collecting before you synthesize it? You know, what about the color of the pot? What about the shape of the pot? What about that black thing hanging out? Aren't those existing from their own side? You didn't have time to project onto them yet. Okay? Aren't those existing from their own side? What about the object which triggers visual consciousness? That's before you even know you're seeing anything. There has to be something out there to trigger that consciousness. Doesn't that exist from its own side? Okay? Isn't that self-existent? In other words, they don't have such a problem with saying, okay, I accept that something like the stupa or a car, I understand how that has, it's a collection of parts, I take some parts, I synthesize it, I make a nice mental image, and I call that car. They say, okay, I can agree with that, I understand that, I accept that. But what about causation itself? What about even the karmic seed in your mind that makes you project? Doesn't that have a reality from its own side? You didn't have time to project onto that. That's causing the projection. Okay? So I understand that maybe at the end it's making a projection. But before it makes the projection, doesn't it exist from its own side? I haven't projected onto it yet. It hasn't even caused my projection yet. Can't it have a reality from its own side? And they struggle with that idea. And I'll give you some of the ideas they come up with, because they don't understand emptiness perfectly. because they're still clinging to something, must exist from its own side. They come up with a few wrong ideas. And this is getting very subtle, but it's important to know. One example is, hey, Lopa, Kunzo, Yanda, Kunzo. Lopa, Kunzo, Yanda, Kunzo. I'll give you an example of Lopa Kunso. And now, by the way, we are in the lower Madhyamika school. Okay? Svatantrika, if you care. Okay? Anyway, it's not the highest school. They say, if everything's a projection, okay, if everything's a projection, and if even projected things are real, and affect us, and work, and cause things, I mean, a projected car can hit you, break your bones, put you in the hospital. It's a projection, but it works. It hurts. Okay. In other words, just because something's a projection, according to you, higher school, doesn't mean that things aren't real. In fact, according to you, it makes them real. So they say, what about the example? It's the famous takta example. Say takta. Takta. There's a coil of rope in the corner. Okay. It has all this pattern on it, which is common in India. You know, if you've ever seen those multicolored ropes with patterns on it. And it's a little bit dark outside, and the dusk is covering the corner, and you come in, and you know there's snakes in Dharamsala, and you walk in your room, and you see that coil thing, and you jump back, and you say, ah, snake, you know. In other words, what about misperceptions? What about when you think something is something, and then it's not? And then you look at it closer and you see it's a rope. Okay. The first perception is called Lopa Kunzo, according to them. Okay. It's a normal perception, which is a boo-boo. Okay. In my experience, I get it a lot. In where I live, there's a lot of oak trees. And in the fall, the leaves all come down. And there's also a lot of squirrels where I live. So you'd be driving down the street, and it's in the fall, and it's dusk, and a leaf gets blown across the road, and you slam on your brakes, okay? That perception just before slamming on the brakes was Lopa Kunzo, according to this school. Mistaken, deceptive reality, okay? And then they say, what about when you get out of the car and you realize it was just a leaf? That's Yanda Kunzo. Yanda Kunzo means a correct deceptive perception, okay? A correct one. All right, so they say to you, Madhyamika Prasangika dudes, if everything's a projection, then isn't the first one just the same as the second one? Isn't the reality of something that you imagine just the same as the reality of something that you don't imagine? Isn't the leaf a squirrel then? Isn't the rope a snake then? Because according to you, they're both just projections and they're correct. You know, that's the way all things exist. Okay, so according to you, if everything's just my imagination, then if I get run over by a car in a dream, well, I'm dead. Okay, and if you say there's a difference between them, you know, one is your imagination and one is not, well, then your whole definition of reality collapses, because according to you, your imagination, meaning your projection, is the only thing that gave it reality anyway. Well, it's a little tricky, okay? The higher school says, look, everything's a projection. You cannot distinguish between something which is a wrong projection and something which is a right projection. They're all projections. It's useless to distinguish between a right projection and a wrong projection. A dream has its own reality, okay? When you go to sleep and you have a dream of a truck, the truck doesn't exist, okay? But what does exist? The dream of a truck, okay? A truck in your dream exists. A truck in your dream which ran you over and broke your legs doesn't exist, okay? But they're both projected. In other words, even fantasies, even imaginations, even dreams, they do have their reality as a dream, as an imagination, as a fantasy, and they are projections. They are results of projections. Prasangika says, no difference. You don't have to go into this stuff. from the point of view of being deceptive, they are the same. A truck in a dream and a truck running you over in real life are both projections. They are not what they seem to be. Okay. They are both deceptive. Why? Not because a truck in a dream runs you over, but because a dream truck seems to be a dream truck independent of your projections. And a truck in real life seems to be a truck in real life independent of your projections. So it's the same thing. You don't have to go into this distinction, they say. Okay? That went over our head. Okay. Anyway, dreams are real dreams. They are not reality, but they are real dreams. You know, and when you imagine a deity in your meditation and you try to visualize a deity, of course it's not the deity itself, but it is a visualization of a deity. And whether you saw that deity in real life or whether you were just visualizing that deity, both of those things come from projection.
So if I dream that I have a death experience of emptiness,
you would have had a real dream of a direct reception. You see, that's the point. It's true. You would have had a real dream of the direct reception of emptiness. Okay? And that's the point. And you would get up, you would wake up the next morning, and when you thought about the dream, you would think it was self-existent. You would say, that dream had its own reality independent of my projections, independent of my past karma. And that would be Kunzo. Same thing, probably. Okay. Yeah, very close to that. Okay. All right. Okay. Anyway, let's skip that. It'll become relevant shortly. Okay. You can say wrong deceptive perception and right deceptive perception. Okay. And Prasangika says, look, they're both projections. And to a normal person's mind, they're both wrong. Okay. Are they both real? Absolutely. Why do you call them deceptive? They don't look like what they really are. Do they both function? Yes. Can a truck in real life run you over? Yes. Does a truck in a dream run you over? No. Can you get nervous from a truck in a dream? Yes. Can a dream truck have an effect on you? Absolutely. If you ever had a really fine dream and woke up and your whole morning went nice, well, then that dream truck or whatever it was made you happy. Okay. It can have an effect on you, but it's nothing more than a dream truck or whatever. Okay. Say Kunshi.
Kunshi.
There's a school called the mind-only school. They kind of like this idea that reality is created by karmic deeds. They kind of get along with the Prasangika on that. Okay. But they say those karmic deeds, what did we call them in Tibetan, remember? Bakchat. People like that word, I don't know why. Say Bakchat. Bakchat. Okay. They say, we like your idea of karmic seeds. In fact, what they really like to say is that Michael Roach's eye consciousness that sees this stupa and the stupa which it sees, both the subject and the object, have grown from the same karmic seed. That's their big deal. That's what they are all excited about. That's the real meaning of mind only. They don't think that the stupa is my mind. But they do think that my mind and that stupa have arisen from the same karmic seed. And that's why they're called mind-only. Okay. But they hold those seeds to be self-existent from their own side. They hold those karmic seeds to not be your projection. Okay. I understand, perhaps, that the mind-only, that these karmic seeds can make you see something. And I understand that they might trigger a projection. But those seeds have their own real existence. They're not waiting for my projection. They came before my projection. So how can they be dependently originating according to your idea of dependent origination? In fact, in honor of the fact that karmic seeds don't come from our projections, we'll put them in a separate part of the mind. Let's call it Kunshi. Okay? Kunshi is another part of the mind according to the mind-only school. They say there has to be a place where we keep all those bhakchaks, which are not just your projection. Okay? And that's what people translate as storehouse consciousness or basis consciousness. In Sanskrit, alaya vijnana, okay? This is the whole point of that. In other words, the mind-only school could not be accepting the idea of another part of your mind called storehouse consciousness, which no other school accepts, if they didn't get it wrong about the nature of a bhakchak, okay? Because they don't understand the nature of a karmic seed, that leads them to the idea of another separate consciousness that's in one corner of your mind, and that's where all those karmic seeds have to stay. Those karmic seeds which are not projections, and which do exist from their own side, and which do exist by definition, and which do exist independently, that those karmic seeds need a place to stay. So we'll call it Kunshi. What I'm trying to point out is that, according to the highest school of Buddhism, most of the weird ideas of the other schools are caused by misunderstanding the idea of projection. You're right, but okay, are caused by not fully understanding the nature of projection. They can't see, for example, how the raw data, the colors and shapes which you project onto, could have been a projection themselves. And that trips them up. That really bothers them. And so they come up with these ideas. The lower Madhyamika school says, say, repeat this, okay? And I'll skip over it fast. Rangi Teniki, Drupe, Yushenle, Rangi Teniki, Drupe, Jebushen, Kepa. Okay. All Prasangika say the Svatantrika, the lower Madhyamika school. We understand how an object that stays still could be a projection. We understand. We understand that, okay, you're collecting the parts together, and we understand how that doesn't exist from its own side. But what about cause and effect itself? Okay. What about cause and effect itself? That has to have some reality outside of your projection. Okay. The causes that create your reality, those bhakchaks, for example, must have some independent existence outside of your projection. For example, the object that appeared to your eyeball just before you were aware of seeing it could not have been projected by you. It must have had some existence from its own side, independent of your projection, because the projection came after that. And they say, results exist naturally because they come from causes that exist naturally, meaning independent of your projections. Things that exist from their own side come from causes that exist from their own side and are independent of your projections. They accept that any particular object might be a projection. They can't see how that applies to the world itself, how things are caused, why things happen. Okay, these other schools are having a big problem with explaining what's projection got to do with why things happen, why the sun comes up, why the clock moves, you know, why sprouts turn into trees. They don't see how that could be a projection. Okay. They accept, okay, maybe the tree, or maybe the clock. But what about movement? What about time itself? What about the fact that things cause other things? Is that a projection? Okay. They have a problem with that. And very importantly, and then I'll take some questions, what about the fact that some things cause other things? How could that be a projection? The fact that certain things cause other things to happen. How could that be a projection? The fact that any action produces the result that you expect. How could that be a projection? Okay. Yeah. Absolutely.
But yeah. I got lost.
It's okay. No, and I'll, you know, up to now you can forget everything. Don't worry about it. But what I want to say is this. They say, I understand how something might be a projection. But when you undertake a certain action to produce a certain effect, how could that be a projection? I don't see how that could be a projection. And we're going to talk about it. Yeah.
I guess the second was, the thing that seemed true was that, if the projections of raw data can be perceived as projections, as a false projection anyway. So my mind tripped off. They're like, how do you ever get out if the methodology of achieving emptiness is pushing time, flashing time, and you're working with your own mind and you're using your own mind, as deceptive as it is,
right.
It's a conflict of self-perpetuating dead end.
It's not, because a projected understanding of a projected emptiness until the point that you can see it directly helps. It functions. It works. Okay? The self, the emptiness, which you are perceiving intellectually, you are perceiving it wrong. Okay? When you perceive emptiness intellectually, you are perceiving it wrong. The emptiness that appears to your mind and the emptiness that you're looking at are not the same. Okay. But it still works. Okay. The Buddha says, use the boat to get to the other side. Then you can sink the boat and walk. You know. And he's referring to the Buddhist scriptures themselves and the teachings themselves. Okay. In other words, as you are thinking about emptiness intellectually, every perception you're having about emptiness is wrong. Because the way it looks and the way it is are still not matching until the day you see it directly. But it works. And that, Nagarjuna's like insistent. You know, he says, don't think that being empty and working are somehow contradictory. You've got to be empty to work. If it wasn't empty, it could never work. Okay. And I'll tell you the punchline about that. Do you think that things in your world outside of your projection are causing other things in your world? Absolutely. That's the big boo-boo. That's why this is the last class. Okay? That's the punchline. Okay? And I'll say it again. The mind grasps on to certain events causing other events self-existently. And I'll give an example. That might be easier. We finished with all this other school stuff now. Thank God. Okay.
Who establishes the hierarchy among gurus and
Their ability to remove your mental affliction. Their ability to remove your mental afflictions.
Okay. If another school could demonstrate that somehow.
Not even demonstrate. If you try it and it gets rid of your anger, it's a higher school. Very cool. All right. The proof is in the pudding. Okay. So forget all the stuff I just talked about. This is the bottom line, okay? As my boss would say, Michael, don't write a report about it. Just go out and buy the diamonds, okay? Okay. Let's say you want to get rich. Okay. And I'm going to give two choices about how to do it. You tell me which one is right. Yeah, I will. I'm giving you two choices about how to get rich. Choice number one is risky investments. Choice number two is safe investments, blue chip stocks. Okay. Now think about it carefully. And when I say go, someone's got to tell me which one makes you rich. Okay? There are opposite things, right? They're contradictory actions. So think about it carefully. It's a test, okay? It's the first question on your homework, honest. Okay? Do you want to get rich? Should you do risky investments? Or should you do safe investments? Ding, 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 ding. Okay. I wouldn't say neither, because some people, like George Soros, is dear to my heart, has made risky investments. In one day, he made $1 billion in England about 2 years ago. In one day. We're asking him for a donation. Okay? In one day. So I say risky investments make money. I'm staking my future Dharma work on it, actually. He says you don't get rich from safe investments. That's not true. I mean, lots of mutual, you know, I mean, lots of big corporations make safe investments, and suddenly they turn around and go wild. And, you know, if you made a safe investment in the internet or something 2 years ago, if there's such a thing. But anyway, but what's the answer? I mean, these are these are apparent causes. They seem to cause. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. That is absolute proof that they are not the cause. Okay. Anytime a particular action sometimes creates the effect and sometimes don't create the desired effect, come on, wake up. It's not the cause. Okay? That's not what caused it. How long you been around this planet? You know? It's so obvious. I mean, people, read the Wall Street Journal. I swear to God. On the first page, there will be something that says, risky investor makes zillions, you know? And then on the second page, there'll be this thing about the bankruptcy. What was that bank in Hong Kong? Barings Bank. Risky investor ruins his bank. You know? The guy on the second page is a stupid head. The guy on the first page is brilliant. They did the same thing. Really? Really? So what I propose is, it's not the cause at all. Wake up. You know, come on. And this is the whole point of this self-existent. These two are self-existent causes. Okay. These two are self-existent causes. They are gotcha causes for rich, for getting rich. What's that mean? They don't even exist as causes for getting rich. Forget it. Okay. They are not causes for getting rich. They are gotcha. Self-existent risky investment and self-existent safe investment are both, they don't even exist. And they couldn't make you rich, so anyway, how could they make you rich if they don't exist? They can't. Okay, what really makes you rich? Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. You see generous people who die poor. Okay? You see risky investors who die rich. And some who die poor. So it doesn't seem to be a cause. I have two answers to that. Okay? The first one is, this relationship between certain ethical or non-ethical actions called good or bad karma. And the results you get from them, the consequences you reap from them, those laws are directly visible only to an enlightened being. Okay. Only an enlightened being can tell you, for example, if you yell at people a lot, you will live in a place that has only a very bumpy dirt road that leads to it. Okay? Seriously. If you want to know where that road came from, I'm absolutely serious. Each person who crosses over that road is projecting onto it bumpy. And they are forced to do so by having spoken harsh words to people in the past. Honest. That's the real reason of a bumpy road. If that road ever gets paved, then all the people who pass over it will have what? They'll have worn out the karma they collected when they yelled at people. Okay. And that's the truth. Okay? All right. Very interesting. If you want the road paved at Vajrapani, I'll give you three choices, and I'm dead serious. This is the road to happiness. I'm not kidding. I'm really not kidding. I'll give you three choices. You talk the county into paving it.
Okay.
You suddenly get a big grant to pave it from some generous person. You do the four powers and you wear off the karma of harsh speech. Which of the above will get the road at Vajrapani paved? In this lifetime, it's done with the right motivation. It's the third. And that's very hard to live by. That's extremely difficult to live by. It's wearing off the karma for harsh speech that will pave this road at Vajrapani. That's very hard to live by. You know, it's extremely difficult to accept.
Okay?
But I'm telling you, anything that goes right in your life is caused by good karma. And anything that goes wrong in your life is caused by bad karma. The connections between harsh speech and rocky roads is something only a Buddha can see directly. So why should you buy it? If I get up here and say, the cause of a rocky road is speaking nicely to people, and if you want a smooth road, you should yell at people. You know, if I get up and say the opposite, if you don't want to be depressed anymore, engage in sexual misconduct, which is the opposite of the truth, okay? Then what's the difference between that and me getting up and saying, if you don't want to be depressed anymore, keep your morality very pure? So who's to say who's right? If only a Buddha can tell. How are we supposed to believe what these dudes say? How are we supposed to act on something that's so far out of our experience? Who could ever confirm it? Either way. And I have two answers for that. Okay, one is what we call Yiche Jepak. Say Yiche? Jepak. Yiche? Jepak. Logical reasoning has two flavors in the Buddhist logic tradition. Okay? Check this out. Okay, everybody see it? Everybody see it? Okay, close your eyes. What happened? Did you see me drop the pen? No. That's a deductive perception. Is it correct? I mean, relatively speaking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Where's that pen? According to Buddhism, you saw that pen drop as truly as if you had stared at it and seen it drop. No difference in the validity of those two perceptions. Okay? You saw it drop as surely as if you had been staring at it. Okay? So logic in the Buddhist tradition plays as great a role as your eyeballs and your ears and your nose and your tongue. You can see things just as good with your logic mind as you can with your eyeballs and your ears and your tongue. There's two kinds of logic. That was the first kind.
Okay.
Based on logic. I mean, you saw me holding it up, you closed your eyes, you heard a bang, you knew I was going to do something weird. And you said, he must have dropped the pen. Okay. What about things like if a Buddha comes along and says, Chimbi Longzhi, I'm sorry, Jimbe Longzhi Chimbi De. Say Jimbe Longzhi Chimbi De. Jimbe Longzhi Chimbi De. Very, very famous statement in Buddhism. Jimbe Longzhi means if you want to get rich, give away things. Chimbi De. If you don't want to be depressed, if you want to have joy in your life, keep your morality.
Okay.
So who's going to confirm it? How can you prove it? Maybe the opposite is true. How do we know? The first answer is called Yiche Jepak. Yiche Jepak means a kind of logic based on understanding the person who said it. A kind of logic based on your understanding of the truthfulness of the person who said it.
Okay?
A kind of logical perception based on your understanding of how that person normally tells the truth about things which I can confirm.
Okay?
The Dalai Lama, in my experience, has never lied to me about anything that I could confirm. Now he's talking about something which I cannot confirm by myself. Do I believe him or not? Normally you'd say yes.
Okay.
And that's the first answer to the question. The Buddha is called a Teme Kebu. Say Teme Kebu. a being of pramana. He cannot lie. If he wanted to lie, he couldn't lie. Because he has absolutely no need to lie. He doesn't need anything from lying. Okay? You have to study enough of Buddhism that everything that the Buddha said, which you can confirm, you have figured out is true. Now the Buddha comes along and says, if you yell at people, this road's never going to get fixed. And then, so what are you going to do? I mean, most likely you'll believe the person. Okay? Most likely. And very importantly, the Buddha has described one true thing that nobody else describes very well. And I would say, I propose, and this is scripture, that on the basis of that one true thing that he said, you can buy the rest of what he says. What is it? The truth of suffering. The truth of suffering. Nobody else got up in front of you and said, this body's a dead end. There's no future to it. Okay? Take care of it in a what do they call that? In a sort of disassociated way, you know? Feed it well, give it good vitamins, and use it to get to where you're going. But it's going to kill you sooner or later. You know, don't get attached to it. Don't worry about making it pretty. You know, don't worry about how much muscles it has or not. Okay? Don't worry about those things. It's a dead end, it's going to kill you. Your relationships cannot go right at this point. Your job cannot go smoothly at this point. Your mind cannot be happy at this point. You are not capable of contentment. The human mind, as soon as it gets what it's looking for, which doesn't often happen, is unhappy within 24 hours and wants something else. A little bit different flavor, please. I got the one I wanted. You can confirm the truth of what I just said. You don't hear it from anyone else except the Buddha. So if the Buddha says something else that you can't confirm directly, think about buying it. Okay? That's the first answer to the question. The second answer is, if you study scripture a lot, and you study the rules of karma a lot, and you study psychology a lot, Buddhist psychology, you could pretty much come up with those things yourself. You know, you could confirm them with normal logic.